Today on Against the Grain, America's unique place in the world, the dream of prosperity for the hardworking. These are some of the myths that the United States has told about itself, but which my guest today argues are now fraying. I'm Sasha Lilly. Critic Eric Chaffetz joins me to talk about the role of ideology in the U.S., from the American Revolution to the present, and why it no longer works. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The United States is built on a series of myths, which have cast the interests of the elite as those of the many. But in the years of economic, social, and environmental crisis following the Great Recession, the political language that has been used to justify the status quo, concepts like the American dream and American exceptionalism, no longer hold the imagination of the majority. My guest today argues that what once could be called ideology, famously conceptualized by philosopher Louis Althusser, has been replaced by something else, what he calls disinformation. Eric Chaffetz teaches English, American Studies, and Native American Studies at Cornell University, and is the author of The Disinformation Age, The Collapse of Liberal Democracy in the United States, published by Routledge. Eric, let's start with the notion of ideology. How has ideology tended to be understood on the left? Who does it serve, and how does it work?
Well, ideology is, I think, typically it's a coherent narrative. It's internally coherent, let's put it that way. And it serves to give the nation as a state, it serves to give power or rationalization. And in that sense, it also masks the power dynamics of the state in giving it that rationalization. So American exceptionalism erases in its ideology Native American genocide, for example. It erases wealth inequalities that have been existent actually for quite a long time, although they've been intensifying, particularly since the Reagan years. So that's how ideology functions, and it thereby provides also, and I think this is crucial, and Althusser stresses this, it provides an identity for people. It provides a narrative into which they are welcomed. He uses the word interpolation. They're welcomed by a larger force, a force that promises to provide for them a stable identity and a stable existence. And to the extent that ideology works, in other words, has some relation to reality, it can function effectively to, if you will, erase the contradictions, the discrepancies in the national narrative. To the extent that it doesn't work, and that's the angle I'm working on it from, what I call disinformation, it detaches from reality completely. This is my argument. And therefore does not provide the stability or the coherence. You really start to see the contradictions that ideology typically provides. Ideology has been defined, although I don't define it this way, and Louis Althusser, who I'm using, doesn't define it this way, has been also called, in from a Marxist sense, a pretty crude Marxist sense, I think, false consciousness. But I think it's more complicated. It's more complicated than that.
Can you explain that?
False consciousness would be, you know, for instance, a belief in the American dream, a belief that if you work hard, mind your P's and Q's, put all your effort into something, that you will advance in life. That's false consciousness. That erases the problematics that many, many people in America work hard, mind their P's and Q's, and don't advance at all. So, I mean, in one sense, that would be the crudest definition of ideology. But I think I'm working on it from a certain standpoint. So right after World War II, unions were relatively strong. 33% of the private sector was unionized at 6% today. So wages actually were rising as corporate profits rose. And there was a promise that seemed credible that slowly but surely minoritized people, women, would enter what looked like rising prosperity. But so in that sense, ideology had some relationship to reality. The American dream looked like, even with all its problems, looked like it could be realized, and to some extent was being realized by, let's say, a minority of the population anyway. So at least there was some anecdotal evidence that that dream, that narrative, was functional. But beginning with Reagan in particular, and clearly that narrative has all sorts of problems historically. Part of the book I do, I look at the work of Edward Pessin, who's a really fine historian, who points to all the income inequality that existed in the antebellum period. So that the myth of you know, sort of upward mobility in America is really, really a myth. The classes have stayed pretty much stable in terms of if you're born into money or if you have resource access, you're typically in good shape. And if you don't have that those resources, it's harder and harder and harder to move up the ladder. But in any event, starting with the Reagan years, income inequality just took off. And that went along with deunionization, of course, the breaking of the air controllers strike, which was the, you know, the cutting edge of the attack on private unions. And now we're seeing with Janus versus AFSCME, the attack on public unions through right to work laws. So that the income inequality really took off. And now we have a situation where about 45% of the wealth is in the top 1% of the population, and 86% of the wealth in the top 20% of the population. So that if you're not in that top 20% of the population, you're struggling. And increasingly then, the narrative, which is a very middle-class narrative, the myth that everybody in America or the bulk of the people are in the middle class, is starting to crumble. The only problem here is that the two main political parties keep using reference from that American dream. Consequently, what you get is a narrative being spun out by the two political parties that has no relationship to reality anymore. Increasing poverty, disappearance of the middle class, wealth inequality, massive wealth inequality, and the way that erodes democracy. That's a situation I'm calling disinformation, where you no longer have a viable narrative.
We're going to talk more about disinformation, but I just want to stay for a moment more with ideology. And you've just been tracing sort of the slide from ideology to disinformation. How do you understand ideology and this dissemination of the prevailing ideas? How do you understand ideology to be generated?
I understand it very much like Althusser understands it. It's generated in the schools. That's his primary site of ideology. So from the time you enter kindergarten, first grade, right time through the time you get to college, and even in college, depending on courses you're taking, that particular narrative, the notion that America is a democracy, for example, the notion that of a middle class, the notion of what you could call bootstrap ideology, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, is that can secede, that America has not committed genocide in order to build its country, that the country is not built on stolen Indian land, which it is, and that stolen Indian land was taken through genocide. The notion that slavery ended in 1865 with the 13th Amendment, when in fact the prison industrial complex perpetuates slavery in very obvious ways. Cheap labor force, unpaid labor force, basically, of largely minoritized people, principally Black people, Native American people, and Latinx people. So I think that the narrative that covers up those discrepancies is promulgated in the schools. I get students. I'm teaching a course right now called The Race and Gender of Poverty in Literature and Film. And, you know, the students coming in will all tell into the class, and I think generally if you polled students, they would tell you that that's the narrative they were getting up through high school with some discrepancies. There are, of course, teachers who raise questions, point out certain contradictions, but by and large, It's a very, very seamless narrative that people are indoctrinated with. And it is a form of indoctrination, it seems to me, which is what ideology does fundamentally. Although it does it, again, in a way that you don't recognize the indoctrination. It becomes natural. Gramsci called ideology, when it's completely naturalized, hegemony. In other words, ideology becomes like wallpaper. You just accept it. It's there. It's part of your life. You don't ask any questions about it. And then it functions to socialize you in very specific kinds of ways, so questions don't get raised. And I think that's pretty obvious in the two major parties. I mean, most of my book concentrates on the Obama years. It doesn't look at Trump. And as I said, Trump seems to me a symptom of a problem, particularly egregious symptom, perhaps. But nevertheless, a symptom of a problem that's been ongoing. And the rhetoric of both parties is that narrative. They have not changed that narrative to accommodate a really radically changing reality in the last 40 years. So that's how ideology functions, and through the school. And then, of course, in your workplace, it will be promulgated in one way or another. Advertising promulgates it in obvious ways. I mean, watching advertising on TV is still like watching, you know, this sort of American dream, which for me now is an hallucination. But it's very dreamlike watching advertising because it's the same sort of upbeat, everything's fine. Just buy, consume, and you have the money, obviously, to consume. You're watching this, so there's a presupposition that as poor as you might be, as struggling as you might be, you know, you're one of the people in these images who are doing well, buying Lexuses or Fords or Chevys, eating, you know, good food, having vacations, looking forward to this, looking forward to that. And so in those institutions, schools, advertising, and then in the workplace in various kinds of ways, and also in popular culture in various ways. And I think popular culture is a mixed bag. There's some pretty tough popular culture that looks at the downside of things, but that typically is not mainstream popular culture.
So why do you think that ideology is no longer functioning the way that it did in the past? Because as you have alluded to, the prevalence of certain ideas are as widespread as before through all these different mechanisms from advertising to education. So why is ideology breaking down, and why do we need to think about another concept, which you call disinformation, to understand the way these ideas work now?
Well, I think ideology is breaking down because the promise of the American dream has lost all relevance. It really has become hallucinatory. So after World War II, you had 33% of a unionized country. Wages were rising with profits. You did have the promise that things could become more inclusive, and more people could enter the American dream. And that's all gone. We have now this massive wealth inequality. We have the breakdown of unions. We have wage stagnation since the Reagan years. People are worse off. Minoritized communities, the African American community, is worse off than it was 30 or 40 years ago. And more of that is being presented. I was watching Al Sharpton on CNN. And he had on a black panel the woman, I forget her name, who's does the leading sort of economic assessments for the Economic Policy Institute. And they were openly speaking about the fact that black people are no better off and in many ways worse off than they were 30 or 40 years ago. So I think there's more information coming out that the so-called American dream is failing a lot of people. 50% of the country, according, if you take the EPI figures, which I think are important, the official government poverty line is $25,000 for a family of four, which is ludicrous. The EPI doubles that to $50,000 for a family of four and calls it the line of material deprivation. And so if you do that, that's about the median income of the country. You've got half the country at or below the poverty line. And that's new. I mean, that is new. That's new in the last 40 years. It's been increasing. And so under those kinds of pressures, the American dream can't hold up. It has lost touch with reality in every respect. In other words, things aren't getting better as they were after World War II, or looking like they were getting better. Things really look like they're getting worse, and they are getting worse. And so any attempt to keep evoking a middle class which doesn't exist, any attempt to talk America is back, or, you know, make America great again, these are sentiments echoed from Reagan through Clinton, through Obama, and now Trump, right? He has to say make America great again, because that's how he won the election. He had to pretend America wasn't great anymore, but that it had been great. But in fact, it's the same exceptionalist viewpoint. This is the greatest country in the face of the earth. You still hear that being said. There's a total denial of our aggressive posture in the world, the tremendous violence we're perpetrating. And we're spending over 60% of our discretionary budget on the military. We control 70% of the world's arms trade. And our violent presence around the globe is manifest. It's certainly manifest to every other country but the United States. At the same time, the powers that be won't touch the military budget, won't talk about touching it. In fact, they increase it, and that's Democrats and Republicans. The arms dealers are making out like bandits. They are bandits, literally. Bandits. We can't have passed gun control in this country because of the tremendous lobbying power of the gun lobby, which is not the NRA is the lobbyist, but who they're representing are the arms manufacturers. And so all of this, is, it seems to me, has come to a head, so that in order to talk the American dream anymore takes a sort of delusional state of mind, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't think it's working on people. I mean, I think the recent election went the way it went because Americans are desperate. They don't believe in the American dream anymore.
And we'll talk more about that as we go on. I'm speaking with Eric Chaffetz. He teaches English, American Studies, and Native American Studies at Cornell University. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're saying that the prevailing ideas that really have shaped America since its inception, changing as they went, but the things that we have inherited, especially around the American dream, are so divergent from people's reality that they no longer have a hold on people's imaginations. But you also said that the idea that Trump channeled, make America great again, that did at least sway some people, obviously, into supporting him and voting for him. Can you talk about the role of the notion of American exceptionalism, and I wonder if you could define that, and the idea of the U.S. as an empire as being something that has been used to kind of keep people in the fold, even when it does seem like the social fabric is fraying. Still, that notion that America is great, America is this imperial power, and we can feel good about America.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the imperial power notion, anybody taking pride in that, is very relatively recent, because the revolution, however conservative the American Revolution was, it was certainly based in certain anti-imperial ideas. And I think it's only recently that somehow imperialism has gotten validated. It certainly was under heavy critique after the Second World War with all the anti-colonial revolutions. And so any positivity that term carries anymore has to come from, I think, a pretty conservative or right-wing area, because America is not supposed to be an imperial power. It's supposed to be a democracy, and imperialism and democracy don't go very well together in the same sentence. So I think that notion, although I think it's true, I think America is an imperial power, and in that sense, it's not exceptional. It is the newest manifestation of the old European imperial powers that in part were broken up by the anti-colonial revolutions at the end of the Second World War. And America has taken over that imperial role and doesn't seem to blush about it at all, which it should, given its so-called democratic heritage. But we've been an imperial power from the beginning. I say the way the country is built on stolen Indian land, and that was perpetrated by a genocide. American imperialism was alive and well through all of that all of that process. It was just being denied, and it was being denied in the name of democracy. We still promulgate the idea that we're doing good in the world, we're bringing democracy to places, and that that's always the function of our wars. It's never the function, which is the truth, that it's about resources, that it's oil, fossil fuels, geopolitical advantage, that we are trying indeed to control the geopolitics of the world. Good luck. And so in that sense, we're functioning as imperial power. And I guess it has become harder to not use that word about America. And the fact that we're using it it seems to me a sign. I'm just thinking here out loud. It seems to me a sign that we were already giving up on the notion of democracy, which was problematic from the beginning of the country. Certainly the founding fathers did not want a democracy. One of the documents I look at, and I really recommend that this should be taught in the schools as far as I'm concerned, is Federalist 10. Charles Beard wrote a wonderful book, The Economic Interpretation of the Constitution. I think 1918 is the date on that book. It's still in print and should be taught widely, in which he looked at the Constitution and pointed out quite simply that this was a document made by the wealthiest people in the country in order to stave off revolution by the working classes, returning soldiers from the revolution, farmers who were in debt. There had been a big rebellion in Massachusetts, Shays Rebellion, by small farmers who were in debt to large landholders. That scared Washington, George Washington and company. And this is all on the record. And they called the Constitutional Convention to get a strong central government so that they could prevent the kind of revolutions that were in the air. The constitutional period is very much a period about redistribution of wealth. I mean, there are real arguments for the fact that even then wealth was at the top of the top of the scale, and there were a lot of people struggling, soldiers coming back from the revolution, small farmers. I've mentioned that. If you look at Federalist 10, and I think this is what people need to see, and it's very clear. They say that, first of all, the acquisition of property, this was written by Madison, who wrote the Constitution, and these were papers in the New York papers. They were editorials promoting the Constitution, which was going to come up for a vote by the states. And so the argument was that that people had different faculties, in other words, abilities, whether natural or acquired, for acquiring property, and that created the class system, which they call factions. And they're very clear about this. There were the faction of the property holders and the faction of the people that didn't hold property. And the first object of government, and I'm giving you a fairly accurate paraphrase without turning to Federalist 10, was to protect those inequalities in property acquisition. That's the first object of government in the Constitution. And people, I think, tend to confuse the Declaration of Independence, which has notions of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and of equality, which is not a legal document, it's a polemical document, with the Constitution, which is a legal document and which has nothing to do. The Bill of Rights was added separately. So initially what it had to do was providing a certain structure of government that would protect the property class. That's Charles Beard's argument. I think it's a sound argument. It's unfortunate that we don't have that argument present, because it's quite clear today that it's worked perfectly. And in fact, what was then a trajectory of property going to the top or being held at the top has really intensified immensely. And in part that has to do because we have no economic Bill of Rights. FDR at the end of the World War II said necessitous men can't be free men. And he outlined an economic bill of rights that he wanted to see put into the Constitution. And he said in his final State of the Union speech, if that did not happen, we were drifting into fascism. And many people will tell you today that that's where we're drifting. Corporate control of the country. I argue we don't have two parties. There are slight differences, but in the major terms, wealth inequality, corporate control, militarization, we have pretty good concurrence between the Democrats and the Republicans, and we've seen that in the current budget debates, so-called, that are going on. So FDR called heads on the United States of America at the end of the Second World War, proposed an economic bill of rights, very specific, health care, decent housing, retirement, all of these things. And where did that go? It disappeared after he died. It was never revived again. And yet, if we don't do that, if we don't redistribute wealth in an equitable way, the country is falling deeper and deeper into what I call an oligarchy. And well, I'm not the only one.
Well, let's talk more about the period in which the Federalist Papers and Federalist 10 were written. And I should say that I'm speaking with Eric Chaffetz. He is the author of The Disinformation Age, The Collapse of Liberal Democracy in the United States. That's published by Routledge. And he is Ernest I. White, Professor of American Studies and Humane Letters at Cornell University. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So at the time that these arguments were being put forward for the defense of property, and John Locke is another figure who is relevant here, there were also counter-arguments and different visions of democracy and property put forward at the same time. Tell us about those.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most telling things is at the end of Federalist 10, Madison, in a sort of quasi-hysterical tone, rails against these plans or these proposals to redistribute property for the redistribution of wealth. So he's quite aware of what he's writing against. One of the documents that I look at a few documents that from that period of time. One of the most interesting documents was the Virginia Constitution, a Bill of Rights, that was published 2 months before the Declaration of Independence. And of course, George Mason wrote it, and he was a colleague of Thomas Jefferson's. And Jefferson based the Declaration of Independence on the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And in the Virginia Declarations, it is not life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, although that's part of it. That's part of the ideology. But also, it is the right to have the means of acquiring property, which was totally erased from the Declaration. In other words, it said, right, that among the rights you're given, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, okay, you have a right to have the means, not the right to property. That's a given. Everybody theoretically has a right to property. But you have the right to have the means of acquiring property. Okay. That disappeared when Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and I would argue it disappeared for the same reason an economic bill of rights does not appear in the Constitution. The other document that I think is worth looking at, that I take a look at, there are many documents that certainly are worth looking at, is Tom Paine's Agrarian Justice. Now, Tom Paine is best known for Common Sense, which was the most popular revolutionary pamphlet at the time, a quote-unquote bestseller, if we can use that expression. In the revolutionary period. And Paine, coming off of Locke, and I have a long sort of look at Locke in the book. Locke is certainly the basis for what we can call liberal democracy. Liberal democracy is based essentially on the right to property, the right to property, not the right to the means of having property, on the notion of individualism. And on rights, on individual rights. So the society is necessarily built, that's what's meant by liberalism. We have now conservatives and liberals in a very different sense, modern sense. But everybody in America, the main politicians, are liberals, classical liberals, in the sense that they believe in private property. They believe in a system of individual rights and of individual ownership. And the hope in the country to begin with is that would sustain a majority of the population, I suppose, so that there wouldn't be open rebellion. One of the things in the Declaration that I think nobody, I was showing it to my class the other day, is Jefferson says right after he talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, he says, look, if the government is not providing you life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you have the right to rebel and overthrow that government. And one of the things I ask my students who are facing massive debt, even though most of them come from relatively, and the top 20% of the country, I'd say Cornell. But one of the things I ask them is, are we in a revolutionary situation? Is the government providing life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness anymore? And I think that's a valid question. In other words, is it taking care of the majority of the people so that they have decent lives? I think that's what Jefferson was getting at. And certainly the Virginia Declaration of Rights was getting at that. So I think that's a question. And many of them now will say no. And then the question becomes, well, what do we mean by revolution? What would a revolution look like? I have some ideas about that in the book. And for me, a revolution would not look like an armed revolution. That's not what I'm thinking about. But a real change in the social structures around the notion of what I would call kinship societies. But maybe we can talk about that later. In any event, Tom Paine wrote Agrarian Justice, and Paine saw the basic inequality in property distribution. So in order to write that discrepancy, that inequality, because he was not against taking property away from the rich, he said there should be a tax on that property, and that a stipend should be given to people newly setting out in life. In other words, people who've reached their majority, they should get a stipend from the government so that they could start life free of debt, with money to make their way in the world. And then he also came up with the notion of Social Security when you reached old age, which then I think the age he proffered in Agrarian Justice is in the 50s somewhere. And you should get a stipend then. So there you have the beginnings of an attempt to articulate an answer to wealth discrepancies. And the very attempt to articulate, of course, indicates that there were tremendous wealth discrepancies. And one of the things Edward Pessin, who I mentioned earlier, the historian, points out is the way wealth was really locked into family inheritance in the antebellum period. There were significant, very wealthy families on the East Coast. He covers the East Coast mostly, who passed that wealth on, who contained that wealth. And so we didn't have really, we had a situation where wealth was already moving or was already located and moving into the top echelons.
How in the neoliberal present is early U.S. history remembered? How has it been shaped by the society we now live in?
Well, I think what's been denied is what I've just pointed out, which is why I make a big deal of in the book, is Federalist 10, the notion that this is a class society. We deny that. You know, the minute anybody mentions class in the two parties, already, you know, they're accused of fomenting class warfare. I would say we probably already have a form of class warfare going on. So I think that the denial of that particular notion that the country was based already around an inequality of wealth. And what gets stressed is not that, of course, but the notion that this is somehow a democratic society. Well, the founding fathers had already worked it out. It was, first of all, it was a representative democracy or a republican form of government. It was not a pure democracy. They were frightened of a pure democracy. And we had a huge country, so trying to collect everybody together in one space to vote on issues, of course, would have been impossible. So they came up with a system of representation. But the way that system of representation worked was the Senate, which was until the 20th century picked by state legislatures, not popularly elected. The Senate was essentially meant to check the House of Representatives, which was democratically elected. Early on, you still had to have some property to vote. That changed with Andrew Jackson. But of course, African Americans, Native Americans, women weren't voting. So huge proportion of the population was not entering into the process. But the process was definitely there. The way the tripartite system of government works, executive, legislative, judicial, was meant there to maintain a status quo in the class situation, I would say, but that has never been confronted. And instead, what we promulgate, and this is ideology, and now I call it disinformation, what we promulgate instead is we stress the sort of democratic notion of America. But in effect, America was founded by people who were tremendously suspicious of democracy, popular democracy, and set up the government in order to check it, should it get out of hand. And that typically means that should those people who don't have much start to feel that pinch and rebel.
Let's talk more about political language in the present, because you're arguing that there is a big gap that has opened up between the prevailing political ideas that come from, let's say, elites in the state, in crude terms, maybe, and then the reality that people are living, their lived reality, especially in the post-Great Recession period. There are two words that we've heard a lot of. One is confidence, and the other is polarization. That's one we hear in the media all the time, that right. Society, the U.S. society has become incredibly polarized. Tell us the significance of those two terms, confidence and polarization.
Yeah, well, as you know, I have some chapters on confidence. I think the pun is intended, so that confidence and con game are very present. One of the most interesting things to me that I covered in the book was this this conference held by some of the richest people in the world, including the Clintons, Mark Carney, the Bank of England, et cetera, et cetera. The International Monetary Fund folks, and they gathered in 2014. Apparently, this Congress, this conference is still going on today, and that was to try to restore confidence. It was called the Inclusive Capitalism Conference. Clinton called it. Larry Summers was there, Mark Carney from the Bank of England, Christine Lagarde from the International Monetary Fund, the Rothschilds from England, huge banking family, et cetera, et cetera. Really the richest people in the world, literally. And they recognized that there had been a crisis of confidence with the Great Recession of 2008, that people didn't trust the financial institutions anymore, the banks, et cetera. And so they were there to try to figure out a way to restore confidence. And so I write about this because what's ironic about it is, first of all, they never admitted their own culpability in bringing about the crash, right? As if they were outside of it. It's what the Democratic Party does today, actually. You know, they criticize the Republicans, but they never take any responsibility for bringing about the conditions that we're in. It's as if, you know, we're for a populist redistribution of wealth, and it's the Republicans who are standing in our way, when in fact they're in both in collusion in supporting precisely the unequal economic institutions that we have. So the Inclusive Capitalism Conference was meant to do with this crisis of confidence they saw. But the only solutions they could promote, as well as denying their own complicity in it, were reforms within the institutions as already existed and self-policing reforms. They basically, in the end, were dependent on the very institutions that could not police themselves and should not be able to police themselves to reform themselves. So there's a bad faith conversation going on in this conference, and I take a look at the papers they read and at the solutions they offered and at the kind of denial that went on in it. So, but they did recognize a crisis in confidence, and I think there is a crisis. There is definitely a crisis in confidence. I don't think people have confidence. The polls, in one sense or another, show this, that people no longer have confidence in our major institutions. And we're still moving along in the wrong direction, I think. In other words, we haven't had open revolt. We haven't had wide-ranging strikes, what have you yet. But I think there has been a definite crisis of confidence, and that's registered, at least in polling. And so I use, I look at Melville's Confidence Man, which is a great book, hard to read, but a great book, which he wrote in 1857 when there was another big crash. I mean, one of the things Americans ought to realize is that capitalism is cyclical. It has crashes and then it bounces back. It has crashes. And if you're caught in the crash and you don't have the wealth to survive the crash, you're finished. And that's, of course, what happens to the poorest people, the African American community. The Latinx community, who had most of their wealth in housing when the whole housing market crashed, they lost tremendous amounts of wealth. White wealth in this country is 10 times that of African-American families.
And then tell us about the reason why we're hearing so much of the other term, polarization.
Yeah, I think in ways, it's not the country that's polarized. It's not people. I mean, people have a certain amount of consensus on things like the need for health care, I basically deny polarization. Let me put it that way. I think the book makes that clear. I see the Democratic and the Republican Party as rhetorically polarized, but unanimous in their support for the military and in their refusal to do anything serious about income inequality. So I see this as a collusive relationship, not consciously collusive, but driven by the ideology that formed the country. So I don't see the polarization. And, you know, the things that have always polarized people are still here, of course. I mean, Trump ran on that. He ran on racism. He ran on xenophobia. He ran on sexism. He ran on all of these things in which a part of the country is lost. And they're lost in part, I think, because they're economically desperate. And, you know, they've been taught to blame people who are more economically desperate than they are, instead of looking upward to the people who are keeping them economically desperate. So in that sense, yes, there is racial polarization. There is gender polarization. But in terms of the two political parties and in terms of what the country needs, which is some economic equity, I don't think there's any polarization at all. I think polarization is itself a rhetorical trick. I mean, let's look at a polarized country, and then that becomes an alibi for not doing anything. And we can't agree on anything. Well, I think, you know, if we had a different government, we could agree on quite a bit.
I'm speaking with Eric Chaffetz. He teaches English American and Native American Studies at Cornell University. And he is the author of The Disinformation Age, The Collapse of Liberal Democracy in the United States. And his other books include The Poetics of Imperialism, Translation and Colonization, From the Tempest to Tarzan. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in your look at U.S. history and the inequality that has been embedded since the beginning and the dispossession and genocide, and then you take things up to a pretty bleak present, how else do you think we could think about organizing our society? How could we get beyond the limits of capitalism's imagination, which often feel like the limits of our own imaginations?
Clearly, I proffer a very specific antidote in the book, which is looking at indigenous thinking, which is based on an entirely different set of values. And that set of values is not about profit. It's not about property. It's about taking care of the community. And it would take me some time to be specific. I'm quite specific in the book about the sorts of practices the Native peoples have practiced traditionally, which have ensured proper distribution of wealth, have ensured proper relationship to the environment, have ensured a proper relationship to each other. I'm not idealizing these communities either. This is not noble savagery.
Sure, and of course, when you talk about Native American societies, they're not just homogeneous. There are various societies with different ways of organizing themselves.
Yes, of course there are. I teach a class called Thinking from a Different Place, which is the last chapter in the book has the same title, Indigenous Philosophies. And so I look at a range of Native American ideas from around the globe, or indigenous ideas from around the globe, Native American, Alaska Native, Hawaiian, Maori, Aboriginal from Australia, in South America as well. I think what we need to do, in fact, some of the most interesting movements around the globe and here in the United States are movements that instead of resisting directly in any armed way the government, are withdrawing from governmental institutions. I think of the Zapatistas, an important model in Chiapas, Mexico, who started with an armed revolution in 1994 and very quickly realized that was going to go nowhere because of superior power in the nation state, but withdrew. Certain circumstances, I'm allowed to do that, and started to develop what are a series of autonomous villages which provide education, which provide food, which provide shelter, people working together in communes, so to speak. And this is a Native American idea. These are largely Mayan people and other indigenous people who are part of the Zapatista movement. Those autonomous villages, which are governed democratically through consensus, which is a traditional indigenous way of doing things, have been quite successful. They provide, by all accounts, a better way of living for the people in those villages, a more equitable way of living, including a very, very focused concentration on gender rights, rights for women, than the other villages in Mexico that are dependent on government support of one kind or another, which has been fairly undermined in Mexico. Communal, there's been a real attack since the 90s on communal farming. And of course, NAFTA destroyed the lives of 10,000 Mexican small farmers. So the Zapatistas have essentially withdrawn and then organized around Mexico with other indigenous communities. And they are going to be running an indigenous woman for president in the next election. They formed a National Indigenous Council. But they're not doing that to join the government. I think this is important. They're doing that to resist the government, to say, look, there is an alternative way to nation-state politics. And I think the nation-state is the problem. I think we have to start thinking against the nation-state and thinking in terms of smaller kinds of units that can be self-sustaining and can trade with one another. If that seems utopian, perhaps it is, but I'm not against utopian thinking, because without utopian thinking, we're headed for, in fact, we're already in a major catastrophe. The climate is not going to wait for us. You can't kick that can down the road. And it is already having tremendous disastrous effects. And of course, it affects the poor in the first place, because they're the most vulnerable in terms of the air, in terms of water, in terms of stable land masses, for that matter. So we need to start thinking from a radically different place. I don't think, you know, part of me says we won't. We won't. And you won't want to be alive in 100 years because it will be hell to be alive, given the way we're going. But unless we start thinking from a different place and start to modify the structures that we have of massive inequality, of climate destruction, and we need to do this in strong ways, in very forceful, aggressive ways. We need to rethink the social system, the environmental system. We're not human beings. The planet will still be here, but human beings are going to be in very, very bad shape. As I tell my classes, too many, millions and millions of human beings are already living this disaster. And I think that's important to point out.
Let's end on that utopian note that you struck a moment ago, given what you're also proffering as a real possible future. When you were talking about organizing society in profoundly different ways, in your book, you write about this concept of buen vivir. Can you explain what that means and how that differs from accumulation and growth?
Yeah, that's an idea that comes out of indigenous peoples in Latin America. It means in Spanish, obviously, the good life. The Quechua word from which the Spanish is a translation is sumac cauce. But the good life does not mean what it means in the American dream. It's the antithesis of the American dream. It's not based on profit, on producing, on progress. Progress is not part of indigenous thinking, because the idea is balance. Balance, if you were to look at various indigenous societies around the world, the key word, however it was articulated in those societies, is balance. The notion that one has to be in balance with one's fellow humans and with the environment as well. And keeping that balance is the most important thing in the world. In the Navajo language, and I've worked a long time with the Navajos, the word is hosho. And it not only means balance, but happiness, beauty, harmony. It has to do then with the good life conceived of as not accumulation, but living in harmony with those around you. And I think it's probably important to stress that indigenous social systems are all based on extended kinship. This is a point I make in the book. And that kinship is not based on blood. It is based on behavior. One of the most astounding things that I've read in my life is Greg Cajete, who's a Pueblo educationist at the University of New Mexico, points out, and this is true, that there is no word in indigenous languages for animal. There is no word in indigenous languages for nature or culture, because these oppositions which exist in Western languages don't exist in native thinking. Differences exist, yes, okay, but not absolute differences. One of the things that allows Westerners to promulgate a system of domination, which is what we have, is the notion, for example, domination over nature, is the notion that culture and nature are opposites, that these are not part of a complex social system, and that culture has the right to dominate nature. In other words, human beings have the right to take from nature, rather than that human beings are a part of nature. And so that exploiting nature means you're exploiting yourself. And that's ultimately what the climate crisis is grounded in, the notion of self-exploitation, exploitation of nature, not recognizing that we are part of the very system that we are destroying, and so that that destruction is self-destruction. That is, these are ideas that don't enter indigenous thinking, I mean, as substantive ideas, because indigenous thinking is based on this notion of extended kinship, that we are all related throughout the world. Everything in the world is related. And so one has to be very careful about the fragility, the intricacy, the complexity of these relationships and respect them. Those are the customs, if you will, the laws, I put that in quote, the laws that govern indigenous relationships, and we need to adopt those laws. That's what environmentalism is about, or should be about.
We're totally out of time. I've been speaking with Eric Chaffetz. He is author of The Disinformation Age, The Collapse of Liberal Democracy in the United States. That's published by Routledge, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches English, American, and Native American studies at Cornell University. Eric, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.